Scott McDonald. I'm a United States Marine Corps officer here on faculty at APCSS. My background is tanks, and I'm also a China Foreign Area Officer, which leads to several interesting jobs throughout my career, and an interest in China combined with a personal interest in philosophy is kind of the background for this brief. So today, my goal here is to walk you through the way that the Chinese think about strategy and warfare, draw some lines to how they are operating today in what the West calls day zero. So without further ado, what is China? Anybody want to hazard a guess? You got to start with the background, okay? This piece of land here, the rough outline is Han Dynasty. Probably, you know what, they gave me this little light here. So the birth of Chinese civilization is here. The Han are probably a little further. Today they count down here, but this is kind of a geographical area called China. When I say China, that's what I think of, along with the culture and language that goes with it. This is the Qing Dynasty, the last imperial dynasty, one of the larger extents of what belonged to the Chinese Empire. Anybody want to hazard a guess what this is? This is the territory claimed by the Republic of China, the government that currently sits in Taipei, Taiwan. This is actually a little larger than the territory claimed by the People's Republic of China. Of course, they claim some stuff that's not on my map, but we won't talk about that right now. So I usually refer to this entity as the People's Republic of China, not China, because they're different things. So first, we want to talk about PRC interests before we talk about what they want to do. But I'm actually not that interested in PRC interests, because the interests we care about are the ones of the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party runs the PRC, and theirs are the interests that matter, because their first interest is maintaining the political system with unquestioned rule by the Communist Party. The Communist Party stays in charge. That is the number one national interest of what we consider the PRC. Number two, defending sovereignty claims and territorial integrity. And number three, economic development. I would argue that these two are primarily important because they help number one. The party has basically made a bargain that we rule, you get stability, we retain China's greatness, we return our lost territory and people we have, and we ensure economic development. So before we talk about how the PRC fights war, what is war? Chinese have a view, and I argue that it's partially rooted in this map. This is a map of late Warring States period. This is a period that went for about 200 years between the Zhou Dynasty, which is pre-imperial China, and the Qin Dynasty, which we consider to be the first Chinese dynasty in 2021. This was a period where several states, several kingdoms, vied for ascendancy. It was constant back and forth. Battles between these two states and alliances formed. Battles over here, stratagem, political maneuvering. A constant state of struggle for ascendancy to protect your interests and gain power over the others. A lot of the way that Chinese philosophy, history, through today, looks at warfare comes from this. And it's unique, right? Well, kind of. Anybody know what this is a map of?
France.
And up here we got part of the British Isles. This map and the coloring represents a snapshot in time, if you will, of the Hundred Years' War, which was fought between competing houses for the French throne, the British throne, which territories belong to the throne in England, which ones belong to the throne in France. And it was a constant back and forth, allies, proxies, subterfuge over 100 years in attempting to resolve who had ascendancy. Not that dissimilar. So it's not completely unknown in the West, this idea of constant struggle. So why is it different today? I would argue this goes back in part to the Peace of Westphalia. The Peace of Westphalia ended the 30 Years' War, another period of mass conflict, largely based on religion, but also competing houses of government, in Europe. It was horrible, right? We're constantly killing people. There's constant conflict. The Dutchies are thrown into chaos. Finally, they got together and they said, hey guys, this isn't working. We cannot have this constant fighting back and forth, your religion, my religion. Let's set some ground rules, right? And what's come out of that, there's not a treaty in Westphalia, right? There's several treaties, there's agreements that over time led to the establishment of the modern state system in Western Europe. But basically, they set the boundaries of state conflict, not just the boundaries of states, right? We're not going to spend all this time undermining each other. Wars will happen, we kind of get that. We prefer not, but there's war, and there's not war. There's us taking care of our own things, not undermining your religion, not undermining your interests. We're going to put the bounds on conflict, okay? And then I threw up the term here, non-interference in the domestic affairs of other states. That's a phrase that the PRC uses all the time today. But basically, they let things be. Right? Until we have conflicts worth fighting over, we're going to let that be. But in Chinese history, they don't have such an event, right? For over two millennia of, maybe over five millennia of civilization, but over two millennia of imperial rule, there was periodic internecine conflict. A dynasty would last 200-300 years. It would be overthrown. There'd be an interregnum, a period of chaos and fighting to figure who out who's going to be on top. More modern, the Republic of China tears apart the Qing dynasty. Many factors involved, right? But defeats them through conquest. Then they disintegrate into warlordism. There was a nominal government. They're competing within the territory of China. The various warlords fighting against other warlords, fighting against the government, fighting sometimes against outside powers, sometimes against inside powers. Constant conflict. And then, of course, the communists pushed the Republic of China off the continent militarily. So, to this day, the outer borders of what we think of as the PRC, they're a mix of imperial expansion and foreign imposition and warfare and subterfuge and rights and wrongs getting all mixed up and leading to the modern borders. There's not an agreement of not pushing on others. So, what is the difference? First of all, I would argue that modern, largely Western, liberal representative systems do not want conflict, right? States maintain international order. We like order. Order is good, it leads to stability, to our economies prospering. And as a result, based on partly our history and our heritage, we think that negotiation can solve problems generally. War is the last resort. You know, even Clausewitz's politics by other means implies that normal politics have failed. The moral relativism that brought on by Kantianism leads us to argue that all values are equal, all value systems are equal. And so we don't want to be imposing our values on others. Right? We don't want others imposing values on us, but it's okay if they have them. And I think if you look at the way that Western states act, this is not just mirror imaging and saying, well, we're this way, so other people must be this way. It's a real desire for this to be true, that this is the way that the world should work and ought to work. And you know what? I think it really kind of does. It's kind of the way the West thinks about that. Of course, the PRC, they don't fit in this mold, okay? As I mentioned earlier, PRC interests are not state interests. They're the party's interests. The party's worried about its survival. China has been unfairly suppressed for over 100 years, the century of shame, and they deserve to be returned to their rightful place, a rightful place that was taken away from them at the hands of other, largely Western, governments. The interstate system is Hobbesian, so that's how we should be acting, and there's a conviction that the U.S. interests and PRC interests ultimately do not align. I'm not saying there aren't areas where cooperation can be found, not just from a Western perspective, but from a PRC perspective as well, but there's also a conviction in the PRC that there are some fundamental interests that just do not align. So this leads to what I argue is a competing concept of war. Now, if you follow the security press at all, the journal articles and such, you know that for the last 5-6 years, ambiguous, gray, hybrid warfare has been all the rage, right? Reams and reams of paper are being expended to convince ourselves that there's something called a gray zone. And this goes back in part to the fact that we want peace, or we want war. And the fact that, events, that actors have caused us to realize that there's something else going on, that there's this skunk here in the middle, is leading us to expend a lot of effort to try to define that and break it off and understand it and put it in a box. Let's understand this gray zone. I would argue that PRC and others, right, Russia is the subject of a lot of gray zone writing, see interstate conflict more as a spectrum. There's not peace on this side and war on this side. There's interstate conflict and competition. And I think that's important to understand the way other people are acting. You don't, if you try to assume that there's some little box you can fit it in that's different than future war, you're going to miss something. You're going to miss the actions people are taking against you every day. And that's why this matters, okay? Because if you look at my argument, all the press you see worrying about gray zone warfare is that the Western liberal representative West is not understanding or dealing with this concept of continuous conflict. It does not fit the world as we want it to be. Okay? However, those who would be U.S. adversaries, they have no problem with this. This is the way wars always happen. This is the way conflict has always happened. And we're continuing that now. So, in some sense, they are at war with the U.S. now. Now, I don't want to, you know, get too far out of the box there and say, you know, this means we're going to be fighting a large kinetic battle shortly. But I use the term war there purposefully, though, advisedly. I want that to shock you a little bit. I want you to think, really, they're fighting us now? And I agree, there's no bullets flying. We don't want bullets flying. I would argue the PRC does not want bullets flying. Flying. However, they see the spectrum of conflict, and they see that they need to be maneuvering against us now if they want to achieve their objectives and protect their interests, and they're doing so today. Therefore, the West is in danger. We spend too much time focusing on figuring out what this gray zone is, which I've just argued doesn't exist. And when we spend all our time trying to put fancy words on it, and we miss what's going on, it's interstate conflict. It may not be bullets and tanks, but it's interstate conflict that other people are waging against us. And if we don't understand that, not only are we not going to see others' actions correctly, we might take the wrong actions. We'll take actions without understanding the other's context, and we actually might stumble into a kinetic war that we don't want. In other words, the U.S. could be defeating itself with its own information by talking to ourselves too much about this gray zone stuff and not actually looking at the world as it is. So, I've talked about war and that it might be going on, but I've said it's non-kinetic. So, I think talking about wars of information is important. And most of the rest of my brief would be couched in this regard. So, I start with how do you win a war? Right. What finishes a war? Anybody want to hazard a guess? How do you win a war?
Raise a flag.
You raise a flag. Okay? Anybody else?
Power sharing arrangement.
A power sharing arrangement? Okay. It would end a war, certainly. People would argue about who won. Yeah?
Both sides agree the war is over.
Both sides agree the war is over. I like that one. Go ahead.
Conditional or unconditional surrender?
Okay. Both of the last two spoke to will, which I think is highly important. Remember, I'm talking about information. I'm talking about cognitive, okay? You can't have a brief on war. We're talking about Clausewitz. I have the Clausewitz quote. The full quote says there are three objectives in war, right? Defeat the enemy's armies, occupy his territory, and break his will to continue the struggle. If he's not convinced that he can't go on, he's going to keep going on, right? Marine Corps Doctrine, Publication 1, because you got to hear from the Marines, right? War is a clash of wills, which I actually think when they wrote that, somebody probably was thought they were channeling Clausewitz there, right? War is a clash of wills. Sun Tzu, the truly great is the general who defeats the enemy without fighting. Well, that's a little bit separated from the ones above, okay? If you defeat him without fighting, how have you defeated him? You've convinced him it's not worth it. Sun Tzu again, because the superior general attacks the enemy's plans. The actual quote, I probably shouldn't use quotation marks here, is the best is to attack the enemy's plans. The next best is to attack his fortified cities. The last best is to attack his armies, right? Go to the plans. What does he want to do? What does he intend to do? Can I stop him before he has a chance to do it? And of course, that great war fighting philosopher, Ma Dilawei, who said, phase zero is a war fighting phase. I'm Ma Dilawei, by the way. So that's my name. So, because the battlefield in the mind is the one that matters, right? If you end a war really by will, if that's how you win a war, is by convincing the other guy that he's lost, the mind is actually really where travels being fought. The armies and the territory, they can be important, but they're not necessarily decisive until you convince the enemy that he is lost. A little diversion before we go further to become one of my favorite Chinese characters, Shur. Shur is one of those fun words that's very hard to translate directly, like Schadenfreude, right? Something fun like that. Okay? And if you pick up a copy of Sun Tzu, and you pick up another copy of Sun Tzu, I can almost guarantee you that they translated this word differently. So that's where some of the problem comes in. In fact, one of his chapters has this title, and it's almost never translated in a way that I would think expresses Sun Tzu's intent. So the concept of Shur is basically, you see it translated as power or energy, but more fully, in any situation there's potential. Right, think of potential energy. And he even draws the analogy to a bow, right? When you pull the bow back, nothing has happened that way yet. But there's a great deal of potential in the situation that currently exists. Based on the potential in that situation, something's gonna happen without you interfering with it, right? As soon as that process is allowed to start, where that arrow is gonna fly, how far it's gonna fly, is already generally set. Things can influence it, but it's generally set, okay? Interfering with a developed situation as that arrow flies downrange is more difficult, requires great effort. For example, changing the course of a river or stream. If I go up into Tibet and I find the source of the Changjiang, the Yangtze River, I can build a little dam out of a few rocks and I can change the course of a mighty river. But if I go down outside of Shanghai and try to change the course of that river, it's a hell of a lot harder, okay? Where is the potential? How can I alter and influence the situation? It's easier to do it if you try to impact the situation early. Make small changes in a way that benefits you towards what you want to happen later on. Mencius, as he's usually translated in English, one of Confucius' disciples, as responsible, one of the great spreaders of his thought. One of Confucius' disciples. He has this great analogy, right? The old man farmer, he comes into the house. I'm exhausted. His son's like, Dad, what'd you do? He's like, I've been out, helping the corn grow all day. What do you mean, Dad? Son's getting nervous. Well, I want the corn to grow big and tall and fast, so I've been out pulling on it. Whoa, Dad, what are you saying? He said, I was helping the corn grow. I was pulling on the corn. I was pulling the corn up to make it taller and higher and stronger. Of course, the son's freaking out now because he knows things have gone bad. He runs out to the field, and of course, the corn is all dying because the dad has destroyed it by yanking on it, by trying to pull it up, by trying to help it grow. Okay? The analogy here is one does not develop a situation by forcing it towards the path that you want. You develop a situation by nourishing it, by giving it what it needs to grow stronger. And in corn, you weed it, you give it water, you give it sunlight, so it develops towards its natural potential. You don't try to force it. Okay? And then my last point there, so the great general has already set conditions for victory well before the battle and already knows the result. He's tended his corn well. He's shaped the situation so the right factors were present. And he's allowed it to grow towards a natural course. He's seen where it would go, and he allowed the situation to develop. Small changes down here affect the way that's going to grow. But it's easier to do a little weeding and do a little watering than it is to yank on corn all day with better results. So my position is, if you go back and you read the chapter, I'm sure, you have to look at the translations. This is hard to do in English to say. But if you think potential, every time you see, depending on the translation, energy or power, and look at what Sun Tzu is trying to say, I think you get a feel for how he's talking about shaping strategy, about shaping a situation. So now that we've talked a bit about how PRC thinks about warfare, this is Scott trying to tell you that PRC is using this to campaign against us now. And I would argue this is their purpose, method, and state. This is me as an observer who studies China looking at how they do this, right? So I think right now, and it's probably isn't the first time you've heard this in this course, but the PRC is trying to establish hegemony within the First Island Chain and build deference to the PRC interests by states in the region. Okay? To do this, I argue, they're conducting activities across the dime, diplomatic, informational, military, and economic components of national power. Activities across the dime that demonstrate PRC's preeminence and reduce the capability and willingness of the United States to intervene. With the end state that the United States is unable to conduct operations within the First Island Chain and without losses that it is unwilling to suffer and does not believe it is in its interest or capability to challenge PRC supremacy. But I told you they don't want to fight, so how are they going to do this? In mind. So I highlighted a few words here, right? Deference, willingness, unwilling, believe, convince the United States and others that it's not worth challenging the PRC. It's not worth it for the losses you'll take, or in some cases, to try to prevent the inevitable. The situation is going to naturally develop this way, why fight it? So it's a message. It's a message war, it's cognitive, so they're messaging to PRC audiences. The United States, of course, is one of those audiences. You can be defeated. PRC is strong, it's rising, we have great weapon systems, we have a way to use them. Within the First Island Chain, you can't make it. They are taking actions across the dime, as I'll show them, that attempt to get this message to the United States. And then you're abroad. Do you have a question?
I'm just curious about that first one, because it seems like perhaps in the medium to long term that would be true, you can be defeated, but it almost seems like right now it's better to sort of, the second point, lull us into a false sense of security until, because I feel that if they understand the United States, they would potentially understand this idea that if we are looking at a face-to-face conflict, that will only make the United States more belligerent or more likely to counter its actions?
I think that's a fair point. What will the United States do if we do X? Not an easy game to play, I agree. I think they are purposefully being subtle in this regard. Little things, I'll say later, Secretary Gates visits Beijing. They use that moment to test fly the J-20. That's messaging.
Yeah.
There's no other reason to do it like that, except the weather was nice that day, I guess. But so there are little things that send little messages added up over time that I think they do. I also think that a few seeds, they have enabled the United States to do this part for them. I think the United States is doing a very good job of helping the PRC convince the United States that the PRC cannot be defeated. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But, so there is a game there between two points that I outlined that definitely conflict a little bit. But they're both messages that the PRC needs us to get. So, and when I hit the information in the military slides especially, you tell me if you think I've covered it. So, next audience, near abroad. Hey, U.S. can't be counted on, right? You cannot resist. PRC is a big country, and you need us economically, both for your own good, but also to keep that U.S. from meddling. They're always causing problems. They always are telling you what to do. Work with us. We'll help you out. And I'm going to touch on this less so in the rest of the brief, but it is important, and that's the internal. And a lot of the actions that they take vis-a-vis the United States or near abroad also have a component directed towards the internal populace, sometimes even more so. Does everybody remember what I said the number one interest of the CCP is?
Retention.
CCP stays in power. That's right. And that's part of it. Okay, so internal China is strong, and the Communist Party, benevolent, loving, your friend and mine, is here to keep social harmony, economic prosperity, and ensure China's resurgence. So, now I'm going to go through the four components of national power. Diplomatic. So, these are an example of a few things that the PRC has been doing over the past several years that I think are used to send messages to help support the narrative that I've outlined in order to meet their objectives. Okay? I like the six-party talks. Actually, I don't like the six-party talks, but I think it's a good example here. Why would the PRC volunteer to run talks with North Korea that are probably going to fail? Right? They look good. They're the big power. They're the responsible stakeholder here, not the United States. And they can keep those talks going and going and going. And if the United States is focused on six-party talks, they're not focused on what the PRC is doing. So that's my little graphic there, key picture I found. The climate change conferences. We'll talk about these two together. I personally think this is brilliant. So 2011 climate change conference in Copenhagen, we're all counting on the PRC. The US president expends a lot of capital, flies to Copenhagen to make sure this deal gets done. PRC, make sure it doesn't get done. We hold the cards here. You need us. We hold the cards. 2015 climate change conference. Who came out the shining example there of wonderfulness? PRC. They saved the world from CO2 emissions. Personal opinion, I don't think they give a damn about CO2 emissions. I think they probably care about the actual concentration of pollutants in the air over Beijing, because it's given them problems. But and maybe if they can find a way to clear that up and meet their other objectives, they'll probably pursue it. But they don't care about worldwide carbon emissions. The whole climate change thing is just an attempt by developed countries to keep undeveloped countries down, taking their coal so they can't develop. So, and that message actually resonates in the region. You talk to developed countries, but you don't want us to use coal? Oh, really? You don't want people to have power? You have the internet, but I don't. That message resonates. So I think these two events, they used very well to show who really matters, PRC. ASEAN Ministers Foreign Affairs Conference in Cambodia, I think we've talked in this course already, how they basically ensured that for the first time ever there would be no joint communique because they did not want South China Sea brought up in a way they didn't want it done. They were in charge. The Xi Ma meeting, President Ma of Taiwan, and President Xi, huge event. The first time the leaders of the Kuomintang and the CCP had met since the Xi'an incident where they kidnapped Chiang Kai-shek from the United Front, much less the president of the two. A lot of people say, Scott, why do you put this on here? This is a mistake. I don't necessarily think it was a mistake. I think Xi was showing he was the big guy, the magnanimous guy. He was really in charge here and was willing to meet the little brother and pat him on the head. North Korea nuke, US THAAD proposal, more recent. China really quick hey, we can solve this, guys, don't worry about it. You take away the bad, they take away the news, everyone will be happy. Well, they kind of knew that no one was going to be happy with that, that they looked a bit magnanimous. Same with a few months later with the nuke and the ROK exercises. Okay? It's about seeing who's important, seeing who's the responsible stakeholder, keeping the U.S. focused on other things. Okay, now agitation. Two tours ago, I was in Okinawa, and as a Chinese speaker, it's fun to watch, I'm not that fun, just how interested the DRC is in that island. And when you look at the anti-American protests and the organizations that help with those things, how much PRC influence there is on that island and where it's directed at. Informational. A few things they're doing. This is Times Square in New York. They had this whole series of these ads. It's actually a video that runs, and all the wonderful things that China is providing the world. Okay? Not lies, right? There's some people doing some good research and stuff, but it shows you the way they're thinking about this. We need the U.S. population to understand that China's a great, wonderful place that we wouldn't possibly want to fight with. Then in 2014 here, these were, I can't remember, the interviews were either on the same day or day, 2 days, or one day after another, on the same topic. This top quote, warned American allies in Asia that the United States become the paper tiger, being asked about Ukraine. That was given to the English language press. In the Chinese language press, he talked about the exact same thing, and he likened Washington's response to the Ukraine crisis to erectile dysfunction. Because the United States is unable to uphold its commitments and will not stand up to force, it's proof that they're an old, infertile, non-vigorous sky. It's a message they're sending to their people, right? They're sending Southeast Asia a message in the one above as well. You can't count on us. The U.S. is weak. It's not an accidental message. 2016, they started kidnapping and incarcerating booksellers in Hong Kong who were publishing books that were not friendly to the PRC or the leadership. Get that information out of the system. We don't want PRC leadership looking bad, either to Chinese citizens or to the region. I thought this was interesting. Anybody come from Washington recently or lived there recently? About the time I moved there, I noticed that when I go to the Washington Post, there were these ads for China Daily right next to the articles you read online. And it was a headline presenting these news, right? And then if you go and you pick up the print edition of the Washington Post, there are whole inserts that are China Daily, right? Chinese view of the world. If you're familiar with China Daily, there used to be you too. There's the Renmin Ribao, the People's Daily, published in Chinese. China Daily was the English language version. Stories were similar, not always exact, because one was for a Western audience, one was for a Chinese audience. And now they're trying to put that in America as mainstream news. Technically nothing wrong with that, right? But just as one more thing, that we need to get our message out to the Americans. We do the same thing, but Washington Post, New York Times, and a couple others get together and they print the International Herald Tribune, which you can get in the DRC in English, but it's largely read by expats. But they see that and hey, we can do this too, right? And ongoing, who is dependent on whom economically? Now notice I put this in information, not in economics. I think this is relevant. What's the strongest economy in the world?
U.S.
Technically still true. You poll Americans, and I actually might have this down on the other slide, most people think it's China. Yeah. It's not accidental, right? And frankly, our news media supports that and keeps pushing it. The world depends on China's economy. It cannot survive without the Chinese economy. I actually think you can dispute that, but the important thing is that's the information in the international space. You can't attack China, our economy will fail. That's good news for China. So military. Growing strength, the Gulf of Aden Patrol. Of course, that was encouraged by the United States. Senkaku, it's a bid for space, right? Not a brain hole, but using force to demonstrate plane. Scarborough Shoal, which you could argue was an outright seizure, and certainly is viewed so by some, including the Philippines. who, from their perspective, were not helped by their treaty ally, Scarborough Sole sends a signal to the rest of the region that you cannot count on the United States. And it employs an old Chinese proverb, you kill the chicken to scare the monkey. Right? And an old Chinese proverb, a guy with a performing monkey, does little tricks for peanuts, one day he stops doing tricks, stops doing what the master wants. Okay, come here, monkey. Chicken. Okay, good trick, right? The monkey starts doing tricks. The interesting thing I find about this is I found several references where it's not the Chinese saying this. It's regional states around the South China Sea quoting the Chinese proverb that the PRC is now killing the chicken to scare the monkey. We're afraid we're the monkey. In other words, we can be next. Plan circumnavigation of Japan. Okay, they sailed the boats around Japan. Yay. But they were sending a message regionally because they hadn't done it before. They went through the straits north and south of Japan, went around Japan, and advertised it heavily. The West got the message. We reported it like a huge, huge deal in our papers, so did Japan. Planned by the People's Liberation Army Navy, in case you don't know. The East China Sea Air Defense Information Zone, they declared. We own this. You have to talk to us before you fly through it. Now, the West did kind of resist that, so did several Asian nations, but there was confusion. There was some Korean airlines started complying initially before they were pulled back by the South Korean government. So, no, you don't have to tell them, you fly through, right? Force the world to react to them, showing they're the ones who have ascendancy. And let's face it, we do A-business too, right? We have A-business all over the world. Our friends have A-business. There's nothing technically wrong with an A-business, but they made it a thing about the territory, who owns what. The oil rig, number 981 of the Paracels, brand new oil rig, mobile at-sea rig, they put off the Paracels as a statement of sovereignty. Why do you have that on military, Scott? Because it was surrounded by Coast Guard vessels and fishing boats, which are used as proxies for the military, because you don't want to have the military out there, you don't want to actually, end up in a shooting war. But the fishing boats and the Coast Guard vessels serve as proxies, play the same role, and there's a plane radar just over the horizon. Really pissed off the Vietnamese, but made a statement about who was what. Done in the aftermath of the takeover of Crimea, and nothing happened. In the invasion in eastern Ukraine, nothing happened. PRC moves the oil. Aleutian Island Transit, okay, they're just making a statement. We're powerful. We can sail what we want. Yes, they can. The customary international laws, we recognize it, says they can sail through the Aleutian Islands, but they do it on purpose and make a statement because they want people to know that the Chinese military is not small and inefficient anymore. They've undergone a national resurgence. Surface air missiles in the South China Sea, it's a military movement that's actually information. This belongs to us. And of course, they get the brand new aircraft carrier, Varyag, former Russian Ukrainian carrier, and its first real drill is done in the South China Sea. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a particularly apparent with this slide, it's a little bit true with both slides. You're painting a very worrisome picture with what I would describe as a bunch of very low risk, low reward operations that really show what a weak hand. And they have a foreign bought aircraft carrier that I kind of doubt can function as a carrier group. And I'm not really sure what the COC looks like. If there is a COC, you've got a disconnected, non-integrated network of SAMs that have been put on a bunch of artificial islands.
Sure.
You have a bunch of absolutely legal Freedom of Navigation acts that are completely okay by international law. I'm not saying that it's not a buildup, it's not an escalation, but at the same time, this is a pretty weak hand. If this is the best you can come out with, then okay.
Fair. Yes, in some senses you're absolutely right. Okay, and though I'm telling you they're waging a non-kinetic war, I absolutely agree they are not an 800-pound gorilla that's about to stomp all over the Western Pacific. In fact, in many ways, I'll tell you, they are much more paper tiger than the West gives them credit for being. However, my purpose is to help understand the way they view the world and the way that they campaign against us. And I selected some stuff that's easy to talk to and people will have some familiarity with. My point is that they view these as part of an overall campaign. And for us to understand why they do things, it's important for us to understand in that context. Yet in some ways, this does present a weak hand. What maybe the counter to that is that because nobody's paying attention, they keep going further and further. And even less than them taking an action that we don't expect or purposely lead a kinetic war, which I don't think they want to do, is that because we don't understand, we're going to have a line, which I don't think we've defined, which is you can't go past this line. But because we're not watching and they're doing it, they're going to think that we have that line, and they're going to think it's over here, and they're going to cross that line, and we're going to not communicate well, and we're going to lead to a war, because we don't understand what they're doing now. Yeah?
Wouldn't you say they've already crossed the line? Because all your examples here, they're not actually touching anything. They're not touching us. Last year, they actually plucked something out of the water, Maritime UAV.
Right, yeah.
Plucked it out of the water and says, oh, I'm sorry, I'll keep it for a little bit and then I'll give it back. So they've already touched us.
Right.
In all your examples, they've not actually touched.
Right. Well, and, when I updated, I took off the impeccable, right, where they actually have attempted to cut stuff of ours, assaulted our vessels, right? And so absolutely they have done more stuff, but I removed a few things as I tried to put more up-to-date things on it. So yes, they are crossing lines ever a little further. I mean, Scarborough Shoal, when that happened, people thought that was way beyond the pale, that would never happen, right? And they did it. And now they're, it just started happening a couple of days ago. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce the name, Paga something island, which is just off of the Philippines, largest holding in the Spratlys that they're now surrounding with fishing boats as well. So they keep going further and further. And it's more the pattern than the intent that I'm trying to draw out. Yeah.
So if we have another situation, I think it was 2003 when the P-3 had the collision with the interceptor.
Yeah, 2001.
2001. Obviously, they're still pushing that limit. They had the interceptor that was inverted above one of our aircraft. They're doing UAV flybys of carriers causing diversions. If we do have another actual impact, do you think that we've been able to recognize these things, what they are, and we'll have to step up? Since 2001 was a lot longer ago, we didn't quite necessarily realize what was happening.
Personal, Scott McDonald's opinion. No, I think if there's another collision, both sides will find a way to very quickly tone it down. Because nobody wants a war. The PRC, and in this regard, you will get a lot of debate in the Western defense community whether or not those, are we calling them aggressive unprofessional intercepts, whether or not those are sanctioned. Or regional commander or hotshot pilots. We debate that a lot because we honestly don't know. But we spend a lot of time focusing on that debate. This could just be an isolated incident. So don't let this become something bigger. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think both sides will try to keep it from becoming something bigger. But your guess is as good as mine in that situation. Depends on how it actually happens, where it happens, what happens to the aircraft. As they fall out of the sky, right? It's, there's many factors that go into how it's handled, I think. Yeah?
So, whole concept, particularly the informational struggle, along with the constant pinpricks to test pressure, it seems very reminiscent of stuff that I remember and have read of Soviet interplay with the United States, particularly 60s through mid-80s. After that, things kind of changed course. Would you say that they're following that playbook? I mean, how does this playbook compare to the OTV?
I think they have a look, and they look at what options are out there, and they take the best, and some are just trying new things. The intercepts, our reconnaissance flights pissed them the hell off for several reasons, right? they can't do the same thing against us right now. They don't want us to collect whatever they think we're collecting. And the presence of them also flies in the face of their interpretation of certain international conventions. So they really, really don't like us doing it. And they're really pushing hard to try to push us back. So they are very focused on that particular issue as well, rather than just, hey, did the Soviets do this? Did it work? Right? So there's a number of things that come into play there. As to whether they actually are taking a trip from the Soviets, I can't say. So on the military thing here, you notice I'm not talking a whole lot about short range, medium range missiles or maneuverable reentry vehicles. You hear a lot about those in strategic press. This is actually from a cover art of a video game, not an actual interpretation of their strategy. But what I would like to say about those most is the informational campaign on PRC novel capabilities that the United States is currently waging against itself. Right? You've probably heard the phrase A2AD, right? Yep, American invention. Thank you very much. You've probably heard they have an impenetrable wall of missiles across the Western Pacific. Not the case. That they have all-seeing eyes everywhere all the time. Not the case, but we're convincing ourselves of that. And so we're convincing ourselves that they cannot be defeated. And that's why I argue that A2AD is a red herring. Let's not focus on that. You don't attack the enemy's missiles, right? Sun Tzu said you don't attack his weapons. You attack the enemy's plans, okay? What are they doing and why? More importantly, what does the U.S. want? Okay, what are our interests and what strategy can gain those? Stop focusing on the weapon systems as you're talking. And Econ, this is the last of the dime. This slide is very focused on a specific period where they were using economics to punish some people. The quote up there, speaking in an English language newspaper to Australia, but Nobel Committee gives the Nobel Peace Prize to someone PRC doesn't like. Okay, well, we'll stop taking your salmon. The Japanese arrest the fishing boat guy who rams them. Okay, no rare earth metals. Philippines files at the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Okay, we won't take your bananas. Not only will we not take your bananas, we won't tell you until you end up on the docks in PRC, and then we have to inspect them, and they rot there, and you don't get any money for them. After they weren't happy with the way the Vietnamese handled the oil rig thing, they slowed down Vietnamese trade across the border over and over again. I got an economic tool. You need me. I can punish you. Tinian Casino, this one's a little bit OBE, to be quite frank, because of some things that took place in the Northern Marianas. But around 2015, they were really pushing the Tinian government hard that you cannot allow the U.S. Marine Corps to come in here and train because we're giving you all this money for a new casino and all these jobs on Tinian, and the U.S. Marines are going to scare customers away. So don't let the Marines use Tinian as a training base. So to a Marine, it was a big deal, our whole realignment in the Pacific and where we're going to put forces and how we're going to train them, Tinian was a big part of that. PRC was actively trying to undermine it with economic incentives. That casino, for other reasons, is now being built on Saipan instead, which they've also mentioned to the Saipan government just how noisy American jets are at the airport. It's going to scare away Chinese tourists, which are becoming an increasingly large percentage of Saipan's economy. Okay, so what is to be done? Only about 23 minutes left, but I'm almost on the slides. So here's way ahead. PRC intends to achieve its end state before the U.S. joins the fight. So much of the battle is taking place today across the dime so that the PRC will have risen, will have rejuvenated. The United States will not be welcome in the Western Pacific in the way they are today, and the PRC gets its way. The effects of these activities across the dime are played out in narratives, right? They're attempting to change will, by the cognitive domain, convince people that their plan is the best way to go. So my argument, the U.S. wants to get ahead of this, they first need to understand it, which is why I gave this brief, and then they need to get ahead of the PRC's OODA loop, We got some non-military people. So everybody familiar with the OODA loop? Boys, okay. Observe, orient, decide, act. It was a theory about how fighter pilots, U.S. fighter pilots, process information more quickly and therefore were able to defeat other fighter pilots and military. We use it in general to decision-making, processing in a dynamic environment. Right now, in this environment, the BRC is making decisions faster than we are. They know what's going on, or they see what's going on, they figure out how it affects them, they make a decision, and they act. The United States is writing more journal articles about hybrid warfare. So, and then, this is something I used to do, communication synchronization, which is a new DoD word for STRATCOM. So this is something the U.S. needs a lot of work on, but we're getting better at. Our actions, words, and images must match. If you're going to compete in the cognitive domain, that's how you do it. And we need to show that the U.S. security guarantee is reliable, our presence is good for economics, the U.S. is a benign power, and frankly, world, you want what we got. And I did the thinking first, I typed it up, and I said, you know what, I got to make sure I messed it. But you know, if you look at that, you can basically draw a line to each of our four national interests as listed in the national security strategy from those four. We just need to do it in the cognitive domain with information. So, just one closing slide here. Unrestricted Warfare, published in 1999 by these two PLA colonels on the way war will look in the future. I think if you read that, you'll see it's very similar to the way I told you Sun Tzu said war was in the past and the way that I'm arguing the BRC is fighting war today. So with that, I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take more questions.